Good afternoon, members of the court. I am Joseph Verneski, number 7973. I'm appearing on behalf of the Colorado Society of Anesthesiologists. Kerry Hershey, the representative of the Colorado Medical Society, is here, but she will not present argument. This, to a small extent, might remind you of the Obamacare argument before the Supreme Court earlier last month. A lot of people showing up to see how the court would react. That having been said, I'd like to introduce Dr. Kristen Wittard. She is in the rose color jacket. She is the president of our society, and she, of course, is interested in what you're going to do today. On September the 28th of 2010, Governor Ritter determined, as a matter of Colorado law, that physicians do not have the right and the duty to supervise the delivery of anesthesia by certified registered nurse anesthetists during surgical operations in certain facilities. We immediately filed an action for declaratory and injunctive relief, and the trial court dismissed our claim in April of 2011 for failure to state a claim. I think there are two pivotal issues for this court to determine this afternoon and in its deliberations. Number one, I think you will have to evaluate the effect of the judicially recognized doctrine of captain of the ship. The trial court below said, I'm going to look at legislative intent, but she did not look at the judicial intent of the Colorado Supreme Court and this court. The second thing you have to do is to determine the intent of the Colorado General Assembly, particularly the legislative history of the 2009 amendments to the Nurse Practice Act. That was something that the trial court did not do either. Having stated those two issues, though, I'd like to take a little bit of a detour because there's one thing that our brief did not adequately do, and that is to examine the conditions of participation which the federal government promulgated and which are the source of the dispute in this case. The conditions apply to three different types of medical facilities. 42 CFR 416.42 deals with ambulatory surgery centers. Now, the factual record in this case is rather sparse, but if you go on the website of the state of Colorado, you will find out that there are 102 of these ambulatory surgery centers. And an ambulatory surgery center, in effect, performs surgical services on patients who did not require hospitalization, drive in, drive out, and bang, it's taken care of. Now, these conditions of participation require that the surgical procedures be performed by a physician. They also require that a physician must examine the patient immediately before the surgery to evaluate the risk of anesthesia and the procedure to be performed. At that point,
counsel, let me just interrupt because I'm a little bit behind where you're going, Evan. You're citing the Colorado regulations or federal regulations?
These are the federal regulations.
That's what I thought. Now, the governor, in the governor's role, certainly has authority to negotiate or do what the governor would do as far as a waiver. Correct? I mean, I'm back on the question of justiciability.
Yes. He has to do two things. Number one, certify that.
But he can do this, whether he made the correct decision or not. I understand you disagree with that, but he, in our three branches of government, he is the one to do this, to negotiate with the federal government about waivers and the like.
If he stopped there, and if the federal regulations stopped there, you would be right. However, what the regulations say is that he must certify that something is consistent with state law. And what the federal government said in promulgating these regulations is that it will not dictate to a state who has the ability to practice medicine and who does not. That is a matter of state concern. Similarly, what the conditions say is that the states themselves will determine what the law is. So to answer your question, yes, the governor can make his determination, but that is subject to whatever procedures are available in the state for challenging that determination.
Well, the executive branch makes determinations all the time, right or wrong under the law. District attorneys decide to charge or not charge, those are all executive agency.
Yes, and but those are the situations where the legislature has said the executive branch will make these determinations, the district attorney will make these determinations. And so that is why we have a difference of opinion here, and that's what the district court found also. Now, what I would recommend that you also do is take a look at these conditions of participation also for critical access hospitals. There are 29 in Colorado, and the rural hospitals, which were subject. They also require that surgery be involved. The point I want to make is this, that we're dealing with surgery, which is perhaps the most demanding aspect of an anesthesiologist or an anesthetist's care. And the question that you have to decide is whether it is subject to physician supervision. Now, that having been said, let's take a look at the two questions that I posed for you. Number one, what is the effect of the captain of the ship ruling? And that doctrine goes back to 1957, and it really relies upon the desire to protect the patient, because being subject to anesthesia, all of his defensive mechanisms are gone, the ability of the patient to breathe is gone, all of the nerves are paralyzed. And essentially what the Beatles versus Mateka case said in 1957 is that there had to be a rule that people who are at the mercy of surgeons performing the operation, it's such that the physicians are charged with the duty to see that no preventable injury results to the patient. As a result, surgery must be performed under the active supervision and direction of the surgeons in charge. So it set up a common law rule, public policy in the state that surgeons direct, they supervise. And in fact, in that particular case, it was another doctor, an anesthesiologist, apparently, who saw the poor patient roll off the table. Now, that doctrine has continued through many years, and the best two recent examples are two decisions in which Judge Casebolt participated in, and that is the O'Connell case and the Ochoa case. And I think you remember, Judge Casebolt, that in the O'Connell case, you quoted from the Beatles case, and you said that the fellow who sold the medical device was subject to the control and supervision of the physician, the surgeon, because he was the captain of the ship. He was running the show. Similarly, in the Ochoa case, the nurses did not count the number of sponges, and one ended up inside of the patient. And the defendant, the physician, said, well, that's the hospital's concern. That's what the protocols say. And Judge Webb's opinion, in which you concurred, said, no, that's not the case. The surgeon is the captain of the ship, regardless of what the regulations are, that still the surgeon must direct and must supervise the nurses. So what do we take away from that? I think we take away the fact that the public policy of the state is for the protection of patients. And I think, Judge Friedman, to go back to your point, the governor does not have the ability to overrule the Supreme Court, nor does the governor have the ability to overrule the decisions of this court. Perhaps the legislature can do something, perhaps the Supreme Court can look at something, but that's not the case here. Now, let's take a look at the second issue.
Before you move on from there, Mr. Brunesky, connect up, if you will, please, your argument about the captain of the ship doctrine and how that impacts the statutory provisions that we're here to talk about.
Well, let me talk about that. I can talk about those in the context of the legislative history. And
I have a problem getting to legislative history unless you think that these statutes and these regulations are ambiguous, because general rules of statutory interpretation are that we don't get to that unless we find an ambiguity.
And the best link between the captain of the ship and the statutes is the definition of medical plan in 1238.104.3. Which basically defines what a medical plan is and what a delegated medical function as part of that is. Essentially, it's very easy. It says, if you have a physician that is devising a plan for the treatment of an individual, the physician has the right to delegate portions of the execution of that plan, but those are under the supervision of the physician. And that's essentially what happened here. And then when the legislature looks at the definition of the role of an advanced practice nurse, what the legislature says, you know, that definition is subject to the fact that the statutory definition in 103.10 that advanced practice nurses perform both independent nurses' functions as well as delegated medical functions.
So in that regard, why is the language, you're sort of reading out of the statute the language that there's an independent function that the nurse serves as well. You seem to be saying that captain of the ship doctrine means that there must be some kind of medical supervision of the nurse, regardless of what the statute says, which says that there's an independent function, if you will.
No, the difference is, I think I'm zeroing in on what you're saying. Let's take the operating room. And let's say that you have a nurse in there, and the nurse is performing independent nursing functions, whatever they may be. She is still under the control of the surgeon because he's the captain of the ship.
If he has a right of control.
It's a good example is the Ochoa case.
Right, if he has a right of control. But if the statute says he doesn't necessarily have a right of control, what does that mean?
It basically means, it's irrelevant in this case because with the administration of anesthesia, there's no question that that's a delegated medical function. So we're not talking about counting sponges. And I guess you and I can have the argument as to whether the independent nursing function of counting sponges would be superseded by the captain of the ship. And frankly, that's not the issue before you today. But you raise the question about whether the statute is ambiguous. And I think the best example of that is back in your office, all the briefs for this case. The governor says that the statute says that CNRAs always act independently. And that's what the trial court said. Colorado Hospital Association says, you know, the statute really doesn't address it one way or the other. It's a vague general pronouncement. And so therefore, the nursing board and the medical board can fill them blanks. And then the Colorado Hospital Association says, well, you know, it's not really independent all the time. Sometimes it's independent, sometimes it is a delegated medical function. Now, with all of that controversy, isn't it a good idea when you're trying to figure out what the legislature meant to go to the words of the legislature to take a look at what happened in 2009 and to take a look at what people tried to do with the statute by creating a thoroughly independent practice, and the legislature said no. So I think that's essentially what the story is all about. I'm going to reserve 2.5 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you.
Good afternoon. May it please the court. I'm Assistant Attorney General Leanne Morrow, and I represent Defendant Appellee Governor John Hickenlooper. With me at counsel's table is Fred Miles, who represents the Colorado Association of Nurse Anesthetists. I will be conducting all of the oral argument on behalf of the appellees here today. I want to start with the governor's jurisdictional argument. Standing is jurisdictional, but I want to also start there because this case presents a set of facts more rare than the mythical creature of the Colorado Plains known as the jackalope. We have a case where plaintiffs do not have standing under Colorado law. Standing requires two things: injury in fact, to a legally protected interest. In this case, the only injury alleged by the plaintiff associations in the complaint was the confusion and misunderstanding that allegedly resulted as a result of the governor's opt-out. Now, one might turn that on its head, that injury on its head, by arguing that the opt-out clarified for all parties, all interested parties before this court, that there simply is no physician supervision requirement for CRNAs under Colorado law, because indeed that was the task that the federal government delegated to the governor in exercising the opt-out. He was required to consult with the Board of Nursing and the Colorado Medical Board and to review Colorado law to determine whether any provision required physician supervision of CRNAs when delivering anesthesia care. The governor did both things. And as the appellants concede in both the complaint and their briefs, both the Board of Nursing and the Board of Medicine of this state voted in favor of both the opt-out being consistent with their respective practice acts and being in the best interests of Colorado citizens. So where is the injury? Where is the injury and confusion and misunderstanding that this court would then exercise its jurisdiction to tread on the discretion of the executive branch of government?
Well, it's my understanding that the trial court went beyond the mere allegation of the complaint about confusion and misunderstanding and said, look, we're talking about physicians who have a stake in who's allowed to practice, both financially, because their practices could be hurt, as well as for patient care, because the patients may receive, in their view, a lower degree of care. Why isn't that sufficient to be an injury in fact to a legally protected interest?
For three reasons, and I'll start with the patient care aspect first. That raises an issue of third-party standing, which in order for the plaintiff associations, who are not associations whose purpose is to protect patient rights in Colorado, but rather to protect the interests of purely private economic interests of their members.
You're saying physicians don't care about their patients?
I'm not saying they don't care about their patients, but in this case, their alleged injury is economic. Their injury is economic. And third-party standing turns on whether the association's members have been injured in fact themselves. So whether they have the right to bring in the interests of patients before this court is the threshold requirement for them to do so is that they have suffered an injury in fact to their own interests. So where is the economic injury? Now you have the affidavit of Dr. Clark that was submitted in response to the governor's motion to dismiss. And that affidavit admitted that if a physician is not an anesthesiologist, he or she is not expected to know how to deliver anesthesia care. So right at the outset, whatever portion of the association's members are not anesthesiologists have not been harmed because they have no qualification to do what they are claiming they have the right to supervise. Additionally, the economic injury in this case is remote and speculative. It's very similar to the injury that was alleged by the bondsman in the Wimberley v. Entenberg case, who basically looked at the court's allowance of a straight bond system between the court and a defendant, sort of sidestepping the need to go through a licensed bondsman, as injuring their unilateral expectation of issuing bonds and garnering fees for doing so to criminal defendants. And in Wimberley, the court recognized that the defendants had no legally protected interest in their unilateral expectation of economic prosperity. Now, I do agree that this issue of economic injury turns on whether the competition between nurse anesthetists and anesthesiologists is lawful. So I do want to spend the bulk of my time here today talking about the regulations that you're here to interpret and that the governor was charged with interpreting in exercising the opt-out.
So I'll ask a similar question that I asked to opposing counsel. Is this properly before us, aside from the question of standing? Is this a justiciable question? It sounds like you think it is.
I would argue as a question that it can be determined as a matter of law, which the trial court properly did, that there is no physician supervision requirement for CRNAs under Colorado law. I do tend to agree with counsel for the intervener defendants and appellees that not only do plaintiffs lack standing in this case, but that asking this court to review the decision of the governor that was informed by the decisions of the Board of Nursing and the Colorado Medical Board does tread upon separations of powers and deference to agency interpretation of its own laws. I hadn't looked at it from the standpoint of just disability in terms of a political question. But I do think that there is a jurisdictional argument why this court should refrain from reviewing the governor's decision, especially where here plaintiffs have not alleged an injury in fact. They've suffered no harm. Going straight to the regs, or I'm sorry, the statute. As was pointed out in the answer brief, appellant's opening brief totally ignored section 1238.111.56, which specifically governs the scope of practice for an advanced practice nurse in the state of Colorado. Advanced practice nurses, such as a CRNA, shall practice in accordance with the standards of the appropriate national professional organization and have a safe mechanism for consultation or collaboration with the physician, or where appropriate, referral to a physician. Now, plaintiffs ignore that provision of the law, a very specific provision of the Nurse Practice Act that is contained in the portion of the act that deals specifically with how advanced practice nurses shall conduct their practice. Additionally, they ignore the provision in 111.8, subparagraph 1, which states that APNs, advanced practice nurses, engaged in an independent practice of professional nursing are required to purchase, maintain, or be covered by professional liability insurance. So what the plaintiffs are asking you to do is basically to turn well-settled principles of statutory construction on their head by adopting a very convoluted and contrived interpretation of the Nurse Practice Act, where this court arrives at a physician supervision requirement based on the more general definition provisions contained in CRS 1238.103, the general definition section for the Nurse Practice Act. Now, not only does that violate the well-settled principle of statutory construction that courts will look to more specific provisions as trumping general provisions, which I want to note that in the reply brief, appellants pointed out that the provisions governing advanced practice nurses, including CRNAs, in the Nurse Practice Act were added after the definition of delegated medical function that's contained in the Nurse Practice Act. They admit that at page 3 of their reply brief. So that would be one exception where the court might look to a more general regulation when there's also a specific provision that competes in the statute if the general provision was passed after the specific provision. But in this case, the specific provisions governing CRNA's practice were passed after the general provisions. The other major flaw in the appellant's construction is that it basically asks this court to ignore what it means for a physician to delegate a task to a licensed professional nurse who is an advanced practice nurse. Now, the definition of delegated medical function in the Nurse Practice Act contains two components. It's an aspect of care that is consistent with and implements a medical plan as prescribed by a physician and is delegated by a physician to a professional nurse. Now, we don't stand before you here today and argue that in no circumstances does an advanced practice nurse ever perform delegated medical functions, that the entire practice for an advanced practice nurse and a CRNA is comprised of independent nursing functions. That instead, we acknowledge that the Nurse Practice Act defines the practice of professional nursing as including both the performance of independent nursing functions and the performance of delegated medical functions. But the Nurse Practice Act specifically states that an advanced practice nurse has an expanded scope of practice for which he or she has obtained special training, special education, and has applied for and been accepted into the Registry of Advanced Practice Nurses by the Colorado Board of Nursing. And as a result of obtaining that special training, that special education, that special scope of practice, nurse anesthetists are required to carry professional liability insurance. If, as appellants contend, the issue of the captain of the ship doctrine is so central to this court's determination, what is the concern with tort liability for the negligence of third parties when nurse anesthetists are specifically required to carry such professional liability insurance? The appellants have contended all along that the captain of the ship argument is a red herring. It's meant to distract this court from looking at the statutes and determining whether any provision of state law affirmatively imposes a supervision requirement on nurse anesthetists. And that was the task that the governor was given. And he was able to review all of the law that we have brought before this court today. And he was not able to find a single provision of Colorado law requiring physician supervision of CRNAs. Returning to the issue of delegation, appellants urge this court to read the definition of delegated medical function as implying that medical plans are comprised solely of delegated medical functions, meaning that a medical plan may not include the performance of independent nursing functions. That is simply not the case. The definition does not limit medical plan to purely the performance of delegated medical functions. So if this court must accept, because the legislature didn't write otherwise, that medical plans may call for the performance of both independent nursing functions and delegated medical functions, then we must revert to the specific statutory provisions that govern the scope of practice for certified registered nurse anesthetists. And in this case, 111.5 indicates that those nurses shall practice with a safe mechanism for consultation and collaboration with the physician. And I want to note that that is not a requirement that the nurses always consult and collaborate with physicians, but that the nurse anesthetists have a safe mechanism for doing so in place. Because I think that part of the problem with the appellant's argument is that they are urging this court to sort of hinge its analysis on these sort of vague readings of statutes that are clear. The governor's argument in the motion to dismiss was that as a matter of state law, plaintiffs cannot point to any provision of Colorado law that requires physician supervision. We would submit, standing here today, that they have not carried that burden. They have not been able to point to a single provision requiring physician supervision of CRNAs. Thank you.
Thank you.
Let me cover a couple of small points and then go back to the issue before you. First, the issue of standing, Your Honor, is correct. The first and second paragraphs of the complaint allege that the function and purpose of our organizations is patient safety. That, of course, confers third-party standing on under all of the cases that we cited. Second, the issue of whether the governor can in any way be reviewed or whether the federal government took away the right of states to do that. The Federal Register pointed out on November the 13th, 2001, that the Congress has left this licensure function to the states, and Medicare recognizes the scope of practice for which health professionals are licensed by states. Given this, we believe states have the responsibility for clarifying their laws and seeking opinions. We're before your court seeking opinions today. Now, finally, let's go to the issue about whether we have a delegated medical function. I'm a political science major, so my clients always cringe when I talk about medical things. Well, let's suppose you have a surgeon, and the surgeon calls in Dr. Woodward and says, okay, I'm going to have a surgery this afternoon, and I want the patient to be awake during the procedure. So I want only a regional or a local anesthetic. The patient has a bad heart, and I'm a little concerned about that for the operation, and I want you, as part of your preoperative examination, to devise an anesthesiology plan that will take into account that bad heart. Now, during the operation, I want you to monitor the heart functions, the EKG, the pulse, and what have you, and help me out on that. And finally, if something goes wrong, I'm going to have my hands inside the patient, and I can't do very much, and I want you to step in and help out. Now, aren't all of those delegated medical functions? And isn't that what we're talking about this afternoon? The legislature recognized that, particularly in 2009, when there were attempts to amend the statute and say that APNs always practice independently. The legislature said, no, we want to get rid of that. When there was a definition for APNs, and the legislature said, well, we want to insert in there the delegated medical functions that they are also expected to perform. This is an easy case. We ask for reversal of the trial court opinion.
Thank you both, counsel, for your arguments this afternoon. This case will likewise stand submitted. To get you a written opinion, of course.